The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hello, this is the Takeaway Podcast for Thursday, August 11th, 2016. And just a reminder, if you want to be on the show, use your phone, leave us a voice memo, and send it to takeawaydigital@gmail.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. As the presidential campaign has settled into insults and hints of bodily harm that are then called the exaggerations of an anti-Trump media or just inexplicable lunacy from a young Trump supporter plucked off the side of Trump Tower, here are some of the things you may have missed in the Middle East. Syrian rebels have broken the Assad regime's hold on Aleppo, and Russia has opened a tiny ceasefire window for delivering relief supplies. 2 million people without water or food, mocking the UN scheduled truce scheduled for later this month. In Libya, relentless fighting in the hometown of former dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi. Sirte has been liberated by essentially being demolished. A pattern seen in Aleppo, Fallujah, Ramadi, and parts of Baghdad. ISIS struck deep inside Baghdad this week. A fire that broke out in a maternity ward in a Baghdad hospital killed 13 infants. In this region, invaded by the U.S. in 2003, and then which experienced a wave of what looked like freedom in a bitterly recalled Arab Spring in 2010, today the repressive so-called Islamic State is among the biggest players in the region, so unfulfilled by promises of democracy from George W. Bush and other American policymakers. As Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump await CIA security briefings later this week, is this statement by Donald Trump an outlandish cheap shot?
President Obama, he is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS, okay? He's the founder.
Of course, it's distorted hyperbole from the master. But there may yet be people in ISIS who might go along with the spirit of that statement. This week, a special issue of the New York Times Magazine takes up the region, the Middle East, the recent history of U.S. invasion and U.S. withdrawal, stories of six unforgettable characters. Sunday's issue is comprised of a single story by reporter Scott Anderson entitled Fractured Lands, featuring stunning photographs by Paolo Pellegrin from deep inside places that Anderson believes for an instant grasp the possibility of hope, only to see it traded for a futureless savagery.
There's 22 Arab countries, and when the Arab Spring started in 2011, they were all affected to some degree. But if you look at the three nations that you would say are truly failed, Iraq, Syria, and Libya today, what they all have in common is they were all cobbled together by the Western powers at the end of World War I. They're all kind of artificial states. And oddly enough, they were all totalitarian regimes. They were not monarchies. So I think what happened when the Arab Spring came along was you're talking about countries with a very fragile sense of national identity. So when the strongman is overthrown, or in the case of Assad in Syria holding on by his fingernails, where people's primary loyalties go to is to tribe or to clan or to their sectarian affiliation.
And how does that explain Egypt? Because there is a very strong national association in Egypt. I mean, Egyptians proudly claim their nationality.
That's it. No, and Egypt is the exception. But to me, the most appalling moment in Egypt was you had Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood president, democratically elected. Within 1 year, some of the same people that had been in Tahrir Square advocating the overthrow of Mubarak were out in the streets 2 years later advocating the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi and asking for the military to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and to me, that was this pivotal moment in the history of the Middle East of, okay, they say they want democracy. Here they have it. It's an imperfect one. Morsi had his own problems. But now you're asking for the military to come back in. I think that was just a really kind of astonishing moment.
We're giving the impression that this is some sort of big picture look at what went on in the Middle East. And in fact, you've chosen six amazing characters who have very different points of view. How did you select these characters to tell the story?
Yeah, I think for most viewers, most readers, the whole region blends together a little bit of what's happening in Syria, what's happening in Iraq. So the idea was to find people from these countries and to tell the history, the story of the past 15 years through their lives and their experiences. Two of the characters are from Iraq. One is from Kurdistan, Syria, Libya, and Egypt. And in every case, these are not extraordinary people. They're not famous people, but extraordinary things have happened to them.
In Libya, it seems that the Arab Spring consisted of excising Muammar Gaddafi, and that was all that was required. Describe how the Libyan situation is both the same as the rest of the tragedy that you speak of, and your character, Majdi al-Mangush.
Majdi is an amazing figure. He was an Air Force cadet in Gaddafi's Air Force when the Libyan Revolution started in February of 2011. He and his fellow cadets were kept on basically a military compound for 3 months, kept in quarantine, and had no idea what was happening around them. Believe the regime's story that, oh, this is foreign mercenaries coming in. It's not the Libyan people. And so for 3 months, he had no idea of what was happening outside of these compound walls. So for the regime, he agreed to sneak back into his hometown and to find who the rebel leadership was, and then to report back to the Gaddafi regime who the leadership were so they could be targeted for assassination. And of course, he discovers everything he's been told for 3 months is a lie. It's not foreign mercenaries. In fact, it's his own family in Misrata who's joined the rebellion. And he does this amazing kind of sting operation where he's going in as a regime spy. He kind of sets up his regime handler in Misrata, and he joins the rebels. For Majdi, where he saw that the revolution had failed, and it's very interesting that it was such a kind of a subtle thing. He got his diploma from the Air Force Academy saying, you're an engineer. You've completed all your requirements. And he said, oh, but I hadn't. I hadn't gone. There had been no classes for a year and a half through the revolution. And what he said about that is like, that to me just proved that everything now in Libya is lies and corruption. And when I got that diploma, I could have gone off and passed myself off as an engineer, but I wouldn't know what I was doing. And that to him was, this is when I knew that Libya was a failed state.
What's his future?
He's determined to stay in Libya. He's back in the town of Misrata, which is probably one of the better off cities in Libya. And ISIS is not in the immediate vicinity of Misrata. But what Majdi probably doesn't fully appreciate is that by all reckoning, Libya is going to run out of money in about a year from now. All its foreign reserves are going to be depleted. So Libya's headed for this economic brick wall on top of the militias, on top of the political crisis in the country. You can just look at your calendar and know that about a year from now, Libya's going to be another huge world concern.
Iraq, of course, is at the center of U.S. involvement in the region. And Khulod al-Zaidi is an individual who has such a huge stake in the future of Iraq.
Yeah, Khulod, she's an amazing woman. She was the youngest girl of a family of six from this provincial city in southern Iraq, very traditional. And when the Americans invaded in 2003, it was like an epiphany to her. Americans came in talking about women's empowerment, democracy, respect for human rights, and when the Americans left, Khulod continued to try to do these women empowerment projects to the point where the militias started coming after her, and they threatened to kill her. She finally, after a couple of very close calls, went into exile in Jordan. And she was seen as so in danger by the UN Refugee Agency. She got this emergency resettlement status. She came to the United States in 2008. But the Americans wouldn't let her family, the part of the family she had brought to Jordan with her. So she went back to Jordan. And she spent the next 9 years in Jordan just stuck. And that's where I met her.
Bitter? Angry?
Only once in all the time I've known her did she ever kind of fall into something close to self-pity. And it was when she was in Jordan and she said, I have no future here. I try not to blame anybody for what's happened, but I just really wish the Americans had thought more closely before they had come into Iraq. And she said, that's what started everything. Without that, we would be normal.
How do you feel about that as an American journalist?
It's played out in different ways, but I don't think the American experience or misadventure in Iraq is really that unique. I think this fits a longstanding American foreign policy tradition, that we decide we're going into a place. We always see ourselves as the liberators. We're never the invaders or the occupiers. When it doesn't work out, we kind of pick up and run.
I remember after 9/11 being told by the Bush administration and others that the way we needed to protect ourselves was to deny sanctuary in rogue, chaotic states. It seems like if we're just talking in terms of square mileage of rogue state sanctuary potential, the last 13 years have increased that by an order of magnitude.
Yes, it's a rogue region now.
It's a rogue region.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is absolutely ground zero of the world's geopolitical concerns now and for the foreseeable future, and yet it's become so dangerous to work there that it's almost ignored. The New York Times has a policy they won't send somebody into Syria. You can go in on the government side, but you can't go in on the rebel side. So with the rise of terrorism and the kind of indiscriminate violence you see in a place like Syria, it's becoming really difficult for journalists to even cover these places.
Is there something that you didn't know in all of your experience that you come away from this whole reporting project with?
It sounds a bit trite to say, but I think I was reminded again of just the resiliency of people in these situations. Khaled al-Zaidi in Iraq, such a strong, dynamic personality that was able to save her own family against all odds. So I think that while I may be pessimistic about the region in general, I think that my relationships with the characters has made me more kind of optimistic on an individual level.
The humans will survive.
Yes.
The political organization is a mess and will have to resolve itself in other ways.
That's right.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, John.
Scott Anderson is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, author of several books, including most recently, Lawrence of Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. Up next, what's the reaction of U.S. veterans to all of this? She's well-spoken and has experience fighting ISIS alongside Iraqi forces in 2013. She doesn't speak for all veterans, but retired Captain Asha Castleberry was eager to join this conversation and respond to Donald Trump's suggestions at a rally last night in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
President Obama, he is the founder of ISIS. He's the founder of ISIS. And I would say the co-founder would be crooked Hillary Clinton.
What's your response?
Of course, that's an exaggerated thought and desperate, if you ask me. That's nowhere near the truth. And if you look at the history of ISIS, a lot of the ISIS fighters came from what you would call Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, where it was formed. It's like extreme Sunni belief or practices that were actually founded in Saudi Arabia, and then it spread and brought in a lot of people into Syria, which created the ISIS organization and spilled into Iraq easily due to the fact that in 2012, when the Maliki regime was marginalizing a lot of the Sunni communities, it was very easy to spread their practices. So no, that is nowhere near the truth.
War with Captain Asha Castleberry coming up next. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.
What do American veterans see when they look at the map of the Middle East? There are many answers to that question, of course. And the history Scott Anderson has plotted lives inside each veteran. That has given a piece of his or her life to years of service in a cause that may be hard to see today. U.S. Army veteran Asha Castleberry was sent to Iraq to help push back ISIS in the Sunni corridor around Fallujah and Ramadi. She believes the 2003 invasion was a mistake, but welcomes the New York Times' comprehensive historical look at the region as something Americans really need to continually revisit.
My perspective definitely focuses on Iraq. I've spent my last portion of my time during my deployment in Iraq, I was actually out there when the counter-ISIS mission started, and actually was I participated in the coalition. So just watching the progress that the Iraqis and the coalition are making to fight against ISIS, that's one thing that I personally have in mind to monitor due to the fact that I learned about the mission when I first was there, and now redeploying back home, I'm learning from the media. It means a lot to me when I do see that we are coalition with the lead of the Iraqi security forces are actually liberating areas like Fallujah and Ramadi, and now they're preparing for Mosul. Progress is very important to us. Especially,
it's slow. It's slow, but...
Yes, it's somewhat slow.
But you see pushback on ISIS.
Yes, especially for the fact that when we first engaged with the Iraqis in 2014, their entire armed forces collapsed. I mean,
brigade... They ran away from Mosul, I remember.
Right, right. As well as commanders need to be retrained. A lot of their equipment was taken away. A lot of battalions just collapsed. And so they had to rebuild their military. Meanwhile, finding a threat.
You were a part of that.
Yes, helping, yes.
And Iraqis that you were a part of that rebuilding effort had a deep sense of their own country or were being paid by the U.S. to be a part of some army?
No, a deep sense of their own country. But under a lot of stress because it's like fighting an actual fight with a broken leg. So, you know, and meanwhile at home you have a lot of things going on in terms of rebuilding your own home. And their achievement was to rebuild national reconciliation. But unfortunately, sectarian tensions were still deep-rooted there. So it's a lot of dynamics that you have to take in place, especially the fact that when ISIS came in, it was just so easy for them to sweep right in due to the fact that sectarian strife was all over the country between Peshmerga folks as well as the Sunni communities and the Shia-led government in Baghdad.
If Iraq never knits itself back together again, if there is this Shiite Baghdad place, this southern Basra place, this Peshmerga-dominated Kurdish zone, and ISIS is moved out of the Sunni area, would that be okay with you if there's still a divided Iraq, even though terrorism has been removed?
That brings up a lot of different arguments called the three-state solution. Actually, Joe Biden had actually spoke about that when he was a senator, and now everybody is just like more in place with pushing for national reconciliation. My argument is no, due to the fact that especially if you form a Sunni autonomy around the Al-Anbar area, there is a likelihood that that area can be retaken by former ISIS fighters or just all, you know, and create some sort of a tension with Saudi Arabia and Jordan or the countries that are actually bordering there. And they do not want to border with a Sunni autonomy that could potentially be taken over by a terrorist group. So it's definitely a regional push to actually bring the country back together.
You know, the Times leaves the impression that this has been a waste. This has been a extraordinary waste of lives and a waste of policy and mission. How do you feel about that?
In terms of the ISIS mission, to a certain extent, I don't feel like it was a waste due to the fact that when we first went in, we had a lot of Americans actually still in Iraq, a lot of contractors over there from 03 to 2011, up to probably about 4,000 Americans still in country. And we had the biggest embassy in the Middle East that's located in Iraq. Then we had a really bad humanitarian crisis going on in Sinjar where the Yazidi refugees were being attacked by ISIS fighters. So if we didn't intervene with the rest of other countries, because there are 65 countries that are part of this coalition, that would have been a very dire situation if we didn't come in and help out with the Iraqis. It would have really unfolded really terribly.
How frustrating is it to you that most Americans don't know these details that you know really, really well?
It's very frustrating, especially during the political season when you have certain candidates that are throwing out the wrong information and you have you know, your constituency who actually believes it. And, you know, some of the thoughts or points that they're throwing out there are so untrue and you can really challenge it. But, you know, if you don't pay attention to the dynamics that are going on overseas, it's just it really creates this unnecessary split or disbelief.
Any idea what you'll tell your grandchildren about what happened?
I do see some optimism in a weird way in terms of my experiences there. I had a great time working with a lot of my Arab allies, especially in Jordan and Kuwait, and with the Iraqis too as well. When I was actually in Iraq, the last time I saw the Iraqis was when they won the Tikrit area, which is the home of Saddam Hussein, and that's a Sunni majority area. So they were really happy and excited to actually liberate Tikrit. But other than that, I mean, I left off from that point and watching them from continuously liberating different areas due to the fact that for some Americans doesn't really mean much. I do see some optimism, but I do see some concerns in terms of sectarian tensions. I think it's very deep rooted in the region. You know, even beyond the ISIS mission, if that is continuous, it's going to definitely bring out the bad side of the region. That's what kind of maintains some of the pessimistic views of the area, is that they have to get over that, the sectarian division.
And meanwhile, we have plenty of our own history here in America to deal with in the next 50 years.
Yes.
Well, Asha, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Asha Castleberry is a U.S. Army veteran who served in Kuwait, Jordan, and Iraq 2012 to 2015 as part of the counter-ISIS military campaign.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. An insurgency in Turkey run by a mysterious Islamic religious leader who lives near Amish country in Pennsylvania. 67,000 officials across nearly every aspect of Turkish society have been sacked or investigated for being connected to the failed coup last month and this Pennsylvania cleric, Fethullah Gulen. He's founder of the Hizmet movement and the Alliance for Shared Values, which teaches a form of Islam that embraces science, education, and interfaith dialogue. He's earned millions of followers both in Turkey and internationally. It's said to have established some 800 schools worldwide, from Africa to right here in the United States. Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has essentially imposed martial law in his country, has hired Canadian lawyer and investigator Robert Amsterdam to nab cleric Fethullah Gulen and expose him as a corrupt recipient of taxpayer funds for running the failed coup, and someone to be extradited for destabilizing Turkey and exploiting young people in the U.S. and all over the world.
He's running 150 charter schools throughout North America. He's under investigation by five different FBI organizations, as well as Homeland. And he's under investigation in the largest congressional ethics inquiry in American history. So believe me, he has been very active, not only in attempting to undermine the Turkish government, but in using the money of U.S. taxpayers to do it.
Who would go to a Gulenist school? What parent, what family would be a candidate for going to these schools?
Well, very few, which is why they don't tell you which schools they are. They do not disclose. In fact, they vehemently deny that they have these schools. And it takes investigation and an understanding of how they operate to identify them. And we've managed to identify over 150. And they all have these telltale signs, and they all use the same suppliers. They vary from a majority Turkish board to solely Turkish administrators to Turkish teachers on H-1B visas. I mean, it's an incredible organization.
You described a moment ago the largest congressional ethics investigation in U.S. history. That seems nearly hyperbole.
I know it does, but there were 200 trips to Turkey funded apparently through Gulen, but not documented properly. And those trips became the subject of this massive inquiry that I think has been referred to the DOJ. But again, that's just a small part of it. When we began this investigation, it was difficult for us to find a state in which the schools operated where his systemic political donations hadn't led to, frankly, an incredible level of penetration of the system here in the U.S. I mean, in Indiana alone, we were told that 400 state and local officials had been sent on trips to Turkey.
What specific evidence do you have that Gulen inspired or triggered or commanded people to engage in this coup?
Frankly, there's a lot of evidence. The Turkish government is putting that together, delivering it to Washington. But the issue of the coup is one I will leave to the Turks. But a man who can organize the type of systemic operation he has in the United States would not have a huge problem organizing a coup in his own country. He has millions of followers. He has a very strict hierarchical organization. They use military-style encryption. And beyond all that, he's educating American students. So I think there's a heck of a lot for your listeners to be concerned about.
Robert Amsterdam is the founding partner of Amsterdam & Partners. He's currently working on behalf of the Turkish government in its case against Fethullah Gulen, the Muslim cleric, allegedly behind the failed Turkish coup in July. Looking for a job with a future in high tech in a sunny spot like Reno, Nevada? Then maybe you might want to check out the factory being built near Reno, Tesla's manufacturing facility for batteries and cars to bring jobs back to the U.S. to make all electric cars exotic and affordable. It will be the largest factory in the world, and whether that scares BMW or not, they wouldn't say the name of their enemy in this ad, noting the long Tesla delivery times.
You will do your taxes twice, maybe more. You will ring in the new year twice, maybe more. You will wait and wait and wait some more, all before that electric car company's new model ever even arrives.
Tesla delivered 50,000 cars in 2015, but needs enough rechargeable lithium-ion batteries to power 500,000 cars by 2020. And they've partnered with Panasonic to build that $5 billion factory in the Nevada desert just east of Reno. Joseph Taylor is chairman and CEO of Panasonic North America. He says among the challenges is recruiting and hiring tens of thousands of employees to operate this plant 24/7.
There has never been a factory this big. It's called the Gigafactory. It will have the largest factory footprint of any factory in the world, not just battery factories. If I recall correctly, it's around 5 million square feet, the size of 130 football fields or three central parks in New York City. It's huge.
And the production will produce batteries for how many cars per year, do you think?
So at full capacity, it will create enough batteries. We rate it on gigawatts. This will create 35 gigawatts worth of energy. It's a huge factory, but it still won't be enough to provide the batteries for all of the cars that Tesla is hoping to build annually. We'll still use our factories in Japan as well as a factory we're building in China.
Have you driven a Tesla?
I have. We had the first S series because we are by far the largest and I think most important partner to Tesla. We had one of the first S series that were produced and we're enjoying one of the first X series SUVs as well.
When you press the accelerator on a Tesla, what is it that tells you those batteries are working? What kind of muscle do those batteries provide that a combustion engine doesn't?
Well, the first way you know the batteries are involved is the muscle that's involved is your neck, because it snaps back into the seat when you accelerate. You've never seen such acceleration or performance in a car. I don't need any gauge to tell me it's working pretty well.
So what are the challenges that go along with manufacturing batteries on such a huge scale as is envisioned in Nevada?
When you look at all of the issues facing us, the single biggest challenge we're facing today is how do we find thousands of workers to run the factory and continue the design of the batteries in a really short amount of time.
So to train people, I mean, is it a lack of trained people in America or something different?
I think it's a combination of things. It's not just trained workers, because we can train people to work in the factories, but it's skill sets involved as well as the number of people we need. So when you look at this gigafactory and you combine our requirements with Tesla's requirements at full capacity, we'll employ combined approximately 6,500 workers. And even in the short term, we're looking at thousands of workers to run not only the machines in the factories, but the engineers and the procurement people and the other professional services, and to find and hire and train literally thousands of workers in that short amount of time has really become the single biggest challenge that both ourselves and Tesla are faced in the short term.
Once you solve that problem, what will the milestone be of this factory? What will its capability be that perhaps rivals battery producers everywhere else in the world?
Well, first let me clarify one thing. We don't have to rival anyone in the world. We are the world's largest battery manufacturer for automotive technology. That's the first thing. The second thing is we make the best batteries in the world in terms of both quality and performance. So our issue is to stay on top of everything, to produce better batteries at higher quality, at greater energy density, and continue the cost curve downward, which will enable Tesla to make their cars much more affordable so that more people can buy them. That's the challenge we face going forward forever.
And is this all lithium batteries?
These are all lithium ion rechargeable batteries. Yes, that's correct.
And is there any particular problem in manufacturing lithium ion batteries at this scale? Any hazards, any worries and concerns? I mean, it's a lot of energy in a very small place.
I think the single biggest issue that we face is maintaining safety and quality. So you're correct. Lithium ion is a very complex chemistry for batteries. And if you're not paying attention in the manufacturing process, you can have lots of different safety issues. So we've championed and led, I think, the world in how to manufacture high quantities of these batteries, maintaining great quality and safety at the same time. And that's really the key to this production facility.
So you're pretty excited about this. So when will the factory be finished?
The factory probably won't be finished for a couple of years, but the first phase of this will be completed either by the end of this year or early next year. As I said, we'll be doing pilot runs before the end of this year. We'll be in a much higher capacity, probably early next year, first or second quarter. The whole production schedule has accelerated. The original plan was over a number of years, and that's all been accelerated. Our plan is to produce batteries to the degree that Elon Musk and Tesla need them. Whatever they need, that's what we're going to provide, and that will determine how quickly we have to keep adding production lines.
Joseph M. Taylor is chairman and CEO of Panasonic North America.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. The Takeaway is on Anchor. If you have the Anchor app and search The Takeaway, it's a great way to reply to one of our questions or chats. And if you're starting a discussion that you'd like us to hear, use the tag The Takeaway.
Music don't change the world.
There's something happening here.
Got to fight the power, don't be. We shall.
Music don't change the world. Only the audience can change the world. But a good songwriter can offer a different perspective.
People Get Ready, our summer of 2016 protest music series, takes us back to where we began this hour. Not to the Middle East, but to a dormant, rarely acknowledged history in our own neighborhood. The indigenous people of North America and the protest voices who are growing in number who insist that the peoples of pre-Columbian times are here in various forms and not just as fronts for casino operations. Check out the Aboriginal Canadian DJ trio called The Tribe Called Red. Their unique brand of powwow step mixes electronic dance music and hip-hop with vocal and drum elements of First Nations music. They fight marginalization, brutality, and poverty, and play sounds that are ancient and fresh. Tim Toolman Hill, a Mohawk who grew up on the Six Nations of the Grand River Reservation, the largest in all of Canada. Hill attended an electric powwow, a monthly club night in Ottawa, and ended up joining the band.
When I went and saw them play for the first time, I saw like this sense of pride amongst people who are Native, and it just kind of like made a lot of sense to me that this was something that was powerful, something that was needed. There was a gap in music that didn't fill that for a long time.
What's going on in the First Nation sort of story in Canada and in North America generally? It seems as though there is a renaissance happening, and it's political, it's cultural, and I would say that A Tribe Called Red is a part of it.
Basically, we aren't supposed to be here. We are born into politics, and it's been like that forever. And what's going on now is that the missing and murdered Indigenous women, who the number keeps on rising, or... And then things aren't really being done about it. So then, you know, that's up to us to kind of step up and bring some awareness to it, to speak on these issues that plague our people, the way that we've been colonized or oppressed, a cultural genocide.
When you think of yourselves as a dance movement, coming straight out of the club scene and the hip hop scene, dance is also deeply it's almost a language of the Mohawk and the people that you come from. How do you mix those, or do they mix?
Anytime you get the drum, it's any kind of music, it's dance music. So all we're doing is mixing dance music, contemporary dance music, with our traditional dance music. They just seem to fit very well and marriage really well together. Powwow isn't traditional to the Iroquois people, but it's something that universally all Indigenous people kind of do and celebrate and use. My people, we do like other dances with water drums and rattles. So the beat of a water drum is almost comparable to footwork.
There's a tradition of sacredness in the sense that some of the great historical leaders and mythological leaders of the Iroquois aren't even allowed, their names are not mentioned. And so I'm wondering if you have rules for what you can sample and what you can't sample. Are there certain things that can't be touched or that need to remain in some sort of sacred space as you sample? Or are you? Is it up for grabs? Anything up for grabs?
We follow a protocol with the powwow. We made sure that it was like okay to do, and we've always listened to elders or anybody that we know that wanted to like say their opinions on stuff. And actually, we do handle everything with respect and sensitivity in that sort of sense. When it comes to Iroquois music, that's something that we haven't crossed yet. We are about to, and these are conversations that we're having for our new album. We work with a Sami artist, and we worked with an Aboriginal electronic group from Australia. We had to like ask permission to use the spelling for certain songs or even the lyrics to it, because it's not ours. You know, it's like It's all of ours. It's everybody's.
You mentioned the problem of indigenous women and the murders. And, you know, hip hop is not known for being terribly respectful of women all the time. You're really turning the tables there.
We talk about the missing and murdered indigenous women and the things that we go through and the things that we think about. It's something that's heavy on our hearts. It just weighs on us so much. I personally would like to know that indigenous women can feel safe in this world.
There are also the environmental disputes over land. You're involved in that?
Yeah, yeah. We have pipeline issues. This is something that we've been finding out. It's worldwide. Like in the Sami people in northern Norway, they're talking about pipelines going through their traditional reindeer herding lands. So this is like it's a shared experience amongst all indigenous people. With the cultural genocide of stuff with residential schools, they tried to kill the Indian within the Indian kind of thing and tried to turn us into them. Because of that, we are still have that connection with land. We feel like it's a duty, you know, to protect it.
We are the tribe that they cannot see. We live on an industrial reservation. We are the Halusa Nation. We have been called the Indians. We have been called Native American. We have been called hostile. We have been called pagan. We have been called militant.
I sense from talking to you that there's a lot of this stuff that's still too powerful to even approach at this point in your musical development, that it's almost too hot to handle.
The more conversations we have about these things, the more that there's an understanding amongst all of Canada and all of the world. We're making a music for Indigenous people. You know, we've been misappropriated in film, media, all of that stuff forever. You know, like we've never appropriated ourselves.
We can certainly see the unbelievably degrading images of Indigenous people in some of your shows. You play those. You make sure people see what's been done and reference murders and killings that have taken place on reservations and on Indian lands as part of your shows. So, I mean, it's not protest music, but, you know, there's plenty to protest, I would think.
Yeah, we have a lot of fuel, let's put it that way. We would love to just celebrate us throwing a party night in Ottawa for Indigenous people as a political statement. I try my best to understand a lot of people and realize that my way isn't the only way. I think that if other people, yeah, just educate themselves, understand that, you know, where we're coming from, you know, we can start having like these really great conversations that could possibly end a lot of things that are wrong with everything.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
Tim Toulmin Hill is a member of the Canadian DJ collective, A Tribe Called Red. Catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
We are the Halusa Nation.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.